The Dr. Taz Show.
The podcast.
Dr. Taz. Your good health journey starts now. Here's Dr. Taz.
Welcome back to the show. Today we have Dr. Alessandra Wall, who is a life coach and a licensed clinical psychologist with a doctoral degree in clinical psychology from the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center and a Bachelor of Arts in Developmental Psychology from Duke University. Welcome, Dr. Wall.
Thank you for having me on.
We are excited to have you on because we really want to dig in and get into kind of what's going on with women and men today in terms of their mental health and trying to really empower them with tools that they can use to move forward in life and kind of break through some of the barriers that many of them that I see are constantly struggling with. So I know you're a clinical psychologist. I also know that you've been doing a lot of life coaching, and I really want to cover both because I think they're both equally important and they sort of serve each other just like the right hand serves the left hand. So talk to us a little bit about your journey as a clinical psychologist. What do you see the most of today? What are things that patients are coming to you with over and over again? I'm just curious to see what that landscape looks like in your world. I know what my world is like, but I'm just curious to see what it's like where you are.
Sure. So the majority of my practice right now is spent working with people who suffer from anxiety disorders or feeling really stressed and overwhelmed and overbooked. And in that sense, there's a huge crossover between what I do clinically and what I do in my coaching practice. But most of the people who are coming in to see me as a psychologist are people who, on a daily basis, are experiencing really heightened levels of stress. Usually they're very smart, they're very driven people, they've tried a number of things, but they can't figure out how to just manage what life is throwing their way. So our job together is to help them understand kind of how anxiety works. I think, somewhat unusual as a psychologist because I look at all levels of lifestyle and practice, mm-hmm. meaning one of the first things I talk to people about is sleep. And with most of my super driven patients, the next thing I'll talk about is their relationship with their cell phones and their email accounts.
No, oh boy, yes.
Right? It's huge, and how to set boundaries and expectations. But then there's also some of the more mindful practices, like the value of slowing down and staring into space and deep breathing. Showing people that there's so many ways to understand feeling stressed and anxious, and a ton of ways of managing those symptoms.
It is such a challenge, and I know that I see a lot of anxiety in practice, and for me at least, it crosses all age groups, all genders. You know, it's almost a universal, and I often tell, you know, I tell everyone actually that a certain amount of anxiety is a good thing, you know, because it makes you driven, it makes you want to succeed, it makes you, you know, strive for more. But too much anxiety is debilitating. You know, who are you seeing with the most anxiety? Is it women? Is it men? Older, younger? Kind of who are the most vulnerable people sort of coming into your practice?
I wish I could draw some line according to gender or age. I think what I'm seeing right now is everybody is really stressed. Probably the people who are struggling the most with addressing the stress are the very driven and the perfectionists mm-hmm. and the high achievers.
So where is that line? And, you know, I'm not going to put myself in that group, but as somebody who tries to do a whole lot and is just incredibly passionate, as I'm sure you are about what we do, where is that line that goes from I'm achieving, I'm on this track? Are there some signs that people can watch out for when that I literally find in practice that people cross a line? It goes from I accomplished X, Y, and Z, I'm on this track, I'm doing well, to either a complete crash where they can no longer function and they're not sleeping and they're going downhill and everything around them is going down with them, or to just this slow slide into a depression almost. It's almost like the anxiety feeds into a depression. Are you mm-hmm. able as a psychologist, have you you know, can you kind of define some of the early warning signs of when that might be happening? So for our listeners out there who, you know, may be driven and motivated and doing really well, but know that they have a little bit of mild anxiety, they can be aware of those red flags if they pop up?
Absolutely. So I will totally put myself in the category of my patients, at least back in
I know. I was like, how honest do I want to be right now? That's totally what's going on in my head. I'm like, should I? Okay, let me be 100% honest. My honesty is that, yes, I am incredibly driven. I do a lot. I keep going. But I have that email cell phone problem that you just mentioned, and I've caught myself, and my children have caught me. That's the joy of having children, is that you have self-correctors all the time, and literally will take it from my hand, and I've learned that I've got to put it away. Otherwise, the type of person I am, I want everything done. So I'll be answering emails all hours of the night if you left me alone. But I've got all these great people around me that are a great check and balance. So I worry about the people out there. I've got friends that are like this who don't have those natural checks and balances in their life. What do they do? What are their warning signs? How, help us, help them try to navigate this so they don't get into that crash mode and they're walking into my office.
So one of the things that I think makes the distinction between being a perfectionist and just being somebody who's driven is rigidity. I think it's wonderful to be driven. Actually, I encourage everybody out there, as best as they can, to try to achieve whatever their highest limit for expectation or excellence is. But the difference between someone who's driven and someone who's a perfectionist is the perfectionist only sees one way of getting to the top, and sees getting to the top as the only thing that represents success. Somebody who's driven will have different priorities. Certain things are very important, and on those they'll want to really achieve a very high standard. But there are other things that they can let go. There are other things in which they can be good enough or do a pretty decent job.
So one of the primary differences then you're saying is rigidity versus perfectionism, correct? So being rigid and being a perfectionist is different than being driven. And I think that's an important distinction to make, because being driven is just always achieving excellence. You're always trying to be your highest self or produce the best. But being, like you're saying, incredibly rigid about it, or trying to make sure everything's perfect all the time, is what can be debilitating. Do I have that right?
Yes, absolutely. Another real good hallmark that, I mean, having others pointed out to you is great, but that you can notice on your own is when somebody who's driven fails at something, and failure is just part of practice, it's part of getting to the top, what they'll generally do is start problem solving. The failure is seen as something that is outside of them, right? When a perfectionist fails, they will get extremely deflated, and they'll start becoming anxious and worried, potentially even angry with themselves or depressed. The failure is seen as something that's internal. It's their fault. It's a personal shortcoming rather than a roadblock that needs to be problem solved and overcome.
I love those distinctions. I think that in itself is helpful. So being driven, you are a problem solver. Being rigid, you're going to take everything personally and as self-defeating. So I think that in itself is so helpful. And just one more question about this. What about physical signs and symptoms? Are there things physically that maybe somebody out there listening would be aware of to know that they're crossing the line from maybe mild anxiety and being driven to kind of headed for a crash?
Yeah, absolutely. Some of the things that we talk about, they're probably terms you'll recognize, as ruminating, right? It's when you obsess on a specific thought and you can't let it go. And even when you try to let it go, your mind constantly goes back to it, but it's non-productive. Again, it's not a problem-solving thing where you're trying to figure out how you work something out. It's more of this repetitive, broken record thought about what you messed up or what could go wrong or what's not going to work. And so that rumination, it's a thought process, but it is really a symptom of it. If you notice yourself on a very physical level, like having headaches very often, feeling like you have to catch your breath, like your chest is tight, having like really tight muscles throughout the day, those are pretty telltale signs of just being anxious and carrying that tension with you throughout your day.
And again, for my listeners, I'm just repeating this because I want to make sure you guys all heard it. But again, it's ruminating. So repetitively thinking the same thoughts over and over again, not being able to let those thoughts go when it's appropriate to let them go. Chest pain or tightening up in the chest, that's a sign that you're sort of crossing that line that we're talking about between being mildly anxious, being driven, to truly be having anxiety and maybe affecting your overall health. And then muscle tension, you know, everything from a little bit of neck tightness to full out clenching your jaw and even having the ringing in the ears. I think those are all differentiators between what can drive you to make you successful versus what can literally drive you into the ground. So I think that's helpful, but you have spent a lot of time and energy also helping not just identifying this in your patients, but also developing tools and techniques through your life coaching to help patients transition away from that. So tell us a little bit about that part of your life and career and how that fits into what you're currently doing today.
Absolutely. So if doing therapy is about helping somebody who's not functioning well get back to their baseline, life coaching is about helping somebody who's at baseline learn how to thrive. So it's this whole spectrum of working with people. And one of the things I noticed in all the people I work with, patients and clients, was that they tended to live their life feeling very much overbooked, but underwhelmed by the things that they were doing, constantly stressed, and constantly reacting to their elements. When that got really bad, I saw them as a therapist. And when it was just kind of starting to crop up or affecting their sense of fulfillment or happiness in life, that's when I usually tend to see them as a coach. So one of the things I work with people to do at all levels is to learn how to slow down, how to think about what you're experiencing, whether it's unhappiness or frustration or anxiety or depression, and before you react to it, to learn how to sit with it for a while and understand it. And that's very, very hard in a world where we're constantly distracted and constantly stimulated and constantly busy.
How do we do that? So we just talked about anxiety. We just talked about the tendency of rumination and repetitive thoughts. The last thing someone anxious is going to do is consciously slow down. So what is your advice to folks like us and to our listeners who are on that track or on that train? How do we slow down? What should we build in? You know, if you were my life coach, what would you tell me and what would you tell my listeners? What are some of the things we should be doing?
One of the things I would recommend you doing is creating a new habit or a new practice. And I know and I realize this is really hard when we have so many other things going on in our life, but creating a practice and a habit of doing nothing. And one way in which I do this with my patients and with my clients is doing this thing called the art of nothing. And in the art of nothing, In the art of nothing, we basically sit down and we start first just 2 minutes and I stare into space. And I know it sounds crazy. I can tell you my patients feel very anxious when I first mention this, but I talk about the importance of creating space and time to let your brain go in standby mode. So this can be really simply done, right? It's not a meditation practice for people who have very, very busy minds. Meditation practices are extremely stressful. I have a monkey brain, for example, so my mind never, never quiets.
Right there with you.
But I can stare into space for a little while. I can daydream. So it can start with something as simple as next time you're heating something up in the microwave, next time you're brewing a pot of coffee, when you park your car in your driveway, take 2 minutes and just stare into space. Look at what's ahead of you. Don't start washing dishes while you're heating up your food. Don't go check your phone while your coffee's brewing. Don't jump out of your car at the end of your day to run into your busy house. Just take 1 or 2 minutes to sit down and stare into space. What you might notice in the beginning is that you'll feel anxious at this idea of doing nothing. And one of the things most human beings tend to do in response to anxiety is avoid whatever makes them anxious. And I tell my clients, I'm like, listen, if the idea of sitting for 2 minutes staring into space scares you, that should motivate you to practice it. Because without being too harsh with yourself, you should be able to look at that reaction and say, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous that I cannot just be without stimulation for a few minutes without feeling panicked. And then
I couldn't agree with you more. And part of me wonders if email and cell phones have worsened this for all of us, because we feel like we always need to be connected. We feel like sort of we always need to be on. But again, the vantage point of having children, it's interesting because I think as driven parents, you often drive your children as well. And so many children today, I know, are overstruck, you know, they're overscheduled themselves, right? They have 5 sports, 3 extracurriculars, academics, you know, they have a list and they have a schedule. And it's been interesting is that we have, as a family, purposely pulled away and tried to really pare down on the different things our 2 children are doing. And my daughter, I see that same anxiety. She's like, I have nothing to do. I go, surely you have something to do, or just, you know, be creative, go have fun somewhere. But even she's 9 now, and she's even having trouble navigating that space of quote unquote unscheduled time, nothing to do, can't go on electronics, you know. So how do we all, both as adults and children, harness this art of nothing? I mean, you're saying 2 minutes every day staring into space, that's one option. Are there other things we could do as well? Does journaling count, or writing? Does being out in nature count? What else? What are some other things we could do to really master what you call the art of nothing?
Journaling would count, except that journaling is busy work. And one of the things I really am trying to encourage people to do is actually to do nothing. So if I grab a journal, I can feel good because I'm being productive, I'm being effective, I'm doing something. Same thing with meditation. We know meditation is incredibly beneficial to the brain. But when I talk about the art of nothing, I'm trying to simplify this process as much as possible for people, and also nearly detox them from this drive to always be active and be productive. So I have an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old. And when my 8-year-old tells me he's bored, I just look at him. I'm like, I guess you can lie down and stare at the ceiling. I'm like, it's okay to be bored. It's okay to have nothing to do. And we don't know how to do that as adults. And we're not teaching our children how to do it either, which is a huge problem. And to tell them being bored is okay. Not having something to do is okay. I know, our brains are designed to thrive on new experiences and information. So you're right. Mm-hmm. Technology, although it serves us, has also made us its slave. We're information junkies, right? And so we constantly want to stimulate our brains, want to get this neurotransmitter to be secreted in there and boosted, this dopamine that makes us feel rewarded. And that's what happens when we learn new things, when we do new things, when we do things that are exciting. And so practicing literally doing nothing, like staring into space, what our ancestors used to do when they would sit on their front porches and just stare out or look at the fire at nighttime, is this really, really important skill to allow the brain to rest a little bit. The other thing it does for most of us is it gives us time and the opportunity to reflect on ourselves. So although I would continue to recommend, like, use these small opportunities, don't take your cell phone to the bathroom, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to England, I did a presentation on this, and they all laughed, and I looked at them and said, you are laughing because you all do it. You all take your cell phone.
I was
going to
say, everybody does this. Oh, goodness.
Right? So that would be a great opportunity. Sit and walk. You talked about nature. Walking barefoot on a natural surface for a few minutes, but kind of mindlessly, up to 10 minutes, will also boost dopamine, but in a very different, soothing, calming way. So that's a great trick. It's a fantastic tool for anxiety management, actually, because it's something that's fairly easily done. Find times to, when you stand in line, to not pull out your cell phone, to not check your email. So it can be done on a large scale. I personally love to spend like 45 minutes at this point, sometimes an hour, doing the art of nothing. But when I started 3 or 4 years ago, it was hard to even spend 5 minutes just drinking coffee and doing nothing else than drinking coffee.
I'm sure you've noticed, like you go anywhere, airport, lines, people are on their phones, restaurants, dinners, everyone's on their phone all the time, you know, and that probably, I would say, is a big reason for a spike in anxiety as well.
Absolutely.
So starting at 2 minutes, work up to five, make it to an hour. Is that
work up to
advice?
Whatever you can work up to whatever you can do. Okay. So yes, starting at two. Work up to five. When I walk people through 5 minutes, I can tell your listeners what will happen. The first few minutes, you're going to feel really anxious. And then there's going to be this dawning of how, again, kind of ridiculous it is to feel anxious about just having the opportunity to take a break. So you're going to get frustrated with yourself. And that's going to be followed with this moment of being in the moment, right, where you feel good and calm. And nearly immediately after that will be this, okay, well, I've done this, I'm good, I can move on. And you'll realize you're at the 3.5 minute mark and you have another minute and a half to go. And I would urge you to just sit through that minute and a half, but you can cycle through that many emotions in 5 minutes. Over time, your brain is going to learn to really appreciate these breaks. Your body's going to calm down. You're going to be able to think more clearly. Your stress levels are going to go down. Your muscle tension is going to go down. So, as you know, most of us don't have the freedom to spend an hour staring into space. I use flight times to do that when I travel. But if you practice something like this 2 to 3 times a day, I guarantee you will notice your anxiety and stress levels will be much lower by the end of the day.
So your clients that you... But your patients in practice, when they put these things into place, are they able, for example, to come off anxiety medications or some of the things that they may be, or even behaviors to manage their anxiety, like smoking or drinking or excessive eating or things like that? Have you noticed those type of shifts?
Yeah, actually, because we'll pair it. So we'll use this as an initial tool to manage the symptoms of anxiety, to manage that tendency to be reactive and to be on the go, 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 go. And then once they have developed a habit of just stopping and checking in with themselves, we use these moments to start asking really important questions like, how am I feeling? What's leading to this tension? What do I want to do about it? So now I'm becoming far more proactive rather than reactive, which lets people stop feeling like ping pong balls all the time.
Right. And not being as dependent on you becoming in control of your emotional response, not allowing external things to control that emotional response. And I think that's so important. Are there other things that our listeners can do to kind of move forward in their lives, to feel balanced and more fulfilled? Other things that you've come across in your coaching or in your life coaching that you would love to share with our listeners?
Yes. Learn to say no. Learn to say no. Learn to set boundaries. When you're given an opportunity, it can be really tempting to say yes to anything that comes your way, any opportunity that sounds fun, that sounds exciting. But that is exactly how we end up in a position of feeling overbooked but underwhelmed. So the next time somebody asks you to do something or asks you to help them with something or you get an opportunity, even one that sounds amazing, stop and ask yourself, not just, is this right? Should I do this? Should is an awful word for many reasons, but is it right for me? Will doing this help me move towards the things that I want to work on, or will it distract me from those things? Will it cause more stress, or will it release stress in my life? So learning to say no, learning
That's
to
critical.
Pick and choose.
Do you find that women have more trouble with that than men, or not necessarily?
Oh, yes, women. Yeah, absolutely. We tend to want to please. We tend to be caregivers. We tend not to want to be seen as obstructive.
Selfish. Yeah.
As selfish, absolutely. Yes. We really struggle with this. And we worry. What I find with most of my female patients, for example, is that they really worry that if they start saying no, people are going to stop liking them.
Right. There's always that concern. I mean, my husband, you know, is so sweet and so supportive. But one thing he has always said is that every time you say yes to something, you're saying no to something else, whether that's your health or your family or food that you may prepare that day to eat or whatever it is. And he couldn't be more true. It's like, you know, every time any of us overcommit or sign up for a whole lot of things, then it's distracting and it's almost unproductive in a sense, you know? So as women, I think that's a constant challenge of just being very clear and being very forceful with who we are at our authentic self and knowing what we want to accomplish and staying on that path rather than getting sort of ping-ponged around essentially, you know, as we walk through life. And some of that naturally happens anyways with children and relationships and being a caregiver and parents and all that other stuff. So there is some of that that's going to happen. But I think I can't stress to my listeners enough that is so important to really dial down into your true self, walk that road, and really kind of put some barriers up so that anything else that comes your way, you can evaluate with sort of a clear mind and clear heart and decide if it's really something for you to do. Anything else you've noticed your patients and your clients doing over and over that you would love for our listeners not to do so that they can live the most amazing life that they are meant to live?
Can I bring it back to cell phones for a second? Because there's something I do that makes me look like a miracle worker in my practice. It's when I find out that people are checking their cell phones first thing in the morning. So the thing that makes me look like a miracle worker is when I can convince somebody who's seeing me to not check their email, their social media, the news, or anything on a screen for the first 15 to 20 minutes of the day.
I love that.
And people will come in within a week and say that they feel amazing.
Mm-hmm. Great, great advice. I think that is amazing advice. And I don't think anyone understands how, I mean, in fact, I think the number one tip for me when I talk to patients is just to put these cell phones away. I think they, for all of us, for myself included, I think they take us to a place of heightened anxiety when we may not be in the best state to deal with a particular issue and we're always dealing with issues over and over again. So that's super frustrating. Anything, I think, as we're nearing our time here, and I want to make sure we get all our important points in, your coaching, your life coaching, you have I think a website called Life in Focus. Am I correct?
Yeah, it's Life in Focus SD because I'm based out of San Diego. But yeah, lifeinfocussd.com is the website, and that's the coaching practice. I would think another big thing is what I call thinking big and acting small.
Mm-hmm.
So it's learning to look at the things you really want to achieve. Like if I had unlimited funds, I would buy an apartment for myself. Now I'm married. I have children. I'm happy in my marriage. It's not that I want to leave them, but I would buy my own apartment. And I don't have unlimited funds, so I can't buy that. But if I look at that dream, if I think big, I realize that what that's about is having a space of my own, having room where things are quiet and peaceful. And then I can take small steps in my everyday life, like practicing the art of nothing or making sure that that I get a few hours on the weekend to be alone, or making sure my office becomes a very personal and beautiful space. These are small things I can do that tap into that dream of owning my own apartment, where, by the way, nobody but me could come into that apartment.
I like that.
And I think what happens with a lot of people is they have big dreams and sometimes dream of things that are not immediately possible, and they feel very frustrated or helpless that those things can't be achieved immediately. But if they can take a minute and think about what is it about those things that would be so fulfilling or that would be exciting or amazing or bring that grin to my face, there are always ways of tapping into those needs, into those themes in your everyday life. They're not as fun always. They're certainly not as sexy as the ideal or the big dream, but they're better than having nothing at all. And those small actions can really help you create a better everyday and feel far more in control and fulfilled by your everyday life, not your vacations, not your holidays, just your everyday. It's a way of loving Mondays.
I love that. And I think those are all lessons we can live by. Dr. Wall, tell us where my listeners can connect with you and learn more about what you do and the tools you offer. What are the best places for them to go?
The very best place to reach me is through my website. It is lifeinfocussd.com. It can be emailed at Alessandra, that's A-L-E-S-S-A-N-D-R-A, at lifeinfocussd.com. And then all the usual places, Facebook, I have a Life in Focus page there. There's an Instagram page. But all of that really can be accessed through the website.
Fantastic. So listeners, remember, think big, act small to realize your dreams, and really master and own the art of doing nothing. These are the secrets to preventing anxiety, but more importantly, for really helping you to live your best life yet. Thank you, Dr. Wall, for sharing all this great information with us. We really enjoyed it. I know I will personally try to use it and put it into place as well. And hopefully we can have you back on the show to learn even more. I really appreciate it.
It was great. Anytime.